CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Dr. Homira Osman will be telling us about Muscular Dystrophy Canada. So what's the latest with muscular dystrophy?
So it has been a transformative time. There have been a lot of changes, I would say, in the past 5 to 10 years. For particular neuromuscular conditions like spinal muscular atrophy, where now there are 3 disease-modifying therapies approved in Canada and available. In addition to that, for spinal muscular atrophy, there's newborn screening for 95% of the country. So that means that when a baby is born, there is a heel prick that is done in that blood that is tested. The panel includes spinal muscular atrophy. So it's a transformative time, and that's, you know, some examples of what's new in muscular dystrophies or neuromuscular conditions.
How does your organization go about reaching out to those affected and might benefit from advocacy and knowing there is hope out there?
Great question. So we have really good representation of a number of neuromuscular conditions. While our name is Muscular Dystrophy Canada, we cover hundreds of neuromuscular conditions. They're individually rare, but collectively common. We support individuals, Canadians, and their family members affected by these neuromuscular conditions through our programs and services. So we have a system navigation program where there is a service specialist who helps guide and really finds resources alongside the person impacted. So whether that be helping to fill out disability tax forms, whether that be to find the funding for wheelchairs, Poyer lifts, hospital beds, and we also have an equipment program that helps to support those pieces of equipment and technologies as well. In addition to that, we have our research hotline. So through that, people can ask questions about their condition, about emerging clinical trials, eligibility, how to participate. In plain language, what do the research studies mean? What are these new research findings? Finding genetic testing or genetic counselors, finding specialists. Those are all parts of the ways we work with the community in really helping to make sure that that neuromuscular journey is easier. And that's one of the key goals.
So do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about neuromuscular conditions?
I think you know, we spoke to this earlier with sometimes thinking muscular dystrophy is a single condition, but rather we know that it's neuromuscular conditions, and that actually is hundreds of conditions. They tend to be progressive, as in they will become different over time or worsen over time in terms of that muscle weakness. But actually, that's not the case for all neuromuscular conditions. The other sort of myth sometimes or misconception is that this is neuromuscular conditions are all genetic. While the majority are genetic, meaning it can be passed down through families or through a spelling change, a mutation. There are neuromuscular conditions that we cover, like myasthenia gravis, that are based on immune-mediated changes, autoimmune conditions, neuromuscular conditions, or myopathies as well that we cover. The other common misconception is that a neuromuscular condition presents at birth in childhood, but that's not necessarily always the case. There are neuromuscular conditions that can present later in life, whether that be in adolescence or young adulthood or, after the age of 50, 60s. So neuromuscular conditions can affect males, females, any ethnicity can present at different times in life. And so oftentimes we do think of young children with neuromuscular conditions, but it can surely impact any age.
So in your time with Muscular Dystrophy Canada, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
That's a good question. I would say the newborn screening initiative that we have helped to lead stands out in my mind. So what this means is that we really helped to lead an advocacy initiative back in 2020, and we have seen life-changing results from it. So back in 2020, when we started this initiative, only Ontario and part of Nunavut were screening for SMA. The rest of the country was not screening for SMA at birth. What that meant for the rest of the country is if a child was born, and if an infant was born with SMA, and they had the most severe form, they likely would pass away by the age of 2. Or they would really present symptoms. It would take, quite a few weeks to get a firm diagnosis. And as you know, with neuromuscular conditions, time is muscle. Oftentimes the damage would be done in terms of that, the muscle wasting. And so that would really result in negative outcomes with the available treatments. What we did is we came in and worked together with clinicians, academics, researchers, laboratories across the country, industry, people with lived experience, people with SMA, their families, and really led an initiative where we supported each province to become ready to add SMA to their provincial newborn screening panel. Now today, with 95% of the country screening for SMA, this means that if a child has SMA, the family's likely to know by 8 to 10 days of life. And they can then choose to treat with one of the 3 disease-modifying therapies that are available. Two that are actually available for infants. One is for age 2 and up. But they're given that choice to treat early and really seek the benefits when being treated early as well. And that avoids a lot of hospitalizations, that diagnostic odyssey going from specialist to specialist, being hospitalized because of respiratory impacts or on the cardiac impacts as well. So that to me stands out as a truly life-changing initiative that we've been part of.
So do you have any advice to any families out there who might just be starting this journey and asking the question, what's my next step, or how can I get better educated, be aware of what my options are?
Yeah, I think I would recommend to connect to a patient organization like ours. Really, when you connect with MDC, we can really help to walk alongside you, really think of us as a GPS where you can put in what your destination looks like. What is that question? What is that desire that you'd like to have based on your individual preferences? And then we can help to navigate and move forward, whether it is around getting trusted information, finding the right resources, connecting you with people, convening, listening to your experiences and advocating, whether it's at an individual level, local, provincial, national, federal level. I think that would be what I would say is a good point when you'd like to get started is connect with the organization, really share your questions. And your lived experience is so important that it is important to share that, share those questions, because it will really help others as well. We always leverage those opportunities to learn from people with the lived experience. so that it can inform how we do our programs, our services, how we deliver our mission.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
My pleasure.
This next interview was a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Jennifer Jovanovsky and Ann Gerard will be telling us a little bit about JMCC. So what can you tell me about the work of the McGivney Center?
Want me to start, Jen?
Good thing.
Well, I think we do great work here. I think in terms of looking at some of the... you know, certainly our services are always expanding and looking to expand. And I think probably one of our main areas that we've looked to expand in is to include families in both the decision-making and input for our services. So I don't know if you want me to expand on that or...
Yeah, kind of a little bit of an overview of some of the work you do. I mean, I know there's a lot of connections between physical rehab, occupational therapy, and keeping up one's academic life.
So again, our center generally is 0 to 19 years old, 21 if you're still in school. Our core services are physiotherapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy, but we have a lot of supportive programs as well, including augmentative communication, our seating department, social work, you know, rec therapy. And we do have a lot of specialized groups to kind of help out families as well. With the family supports, you know, we've really moved to more of a family-centered kind of approach where the families are taking more leadership in terms of figuring out what goals they really want to work on for their kids, and then we work to support that. We've initiated kind of a family advisory committee as well as a youth advisory committee to kind of provide input into the programs that we're doing. And I think our big one that we're, you know, just kind of tapping into right now that is causing a lot of excitement is our life skills program. So both our social work department and our occupational therapy department are working with clients to improve their independence for life after John McGivney. So we're really excited about that. We've received funding actually for that to support that as well. So I think that's one of the bigger kind of feathers in our cap that we're working on right now.
So how do you reach out to the disability community to let them know that your services and supports are available?
So Jen can jump in if she wants, but generally, you know, a lot of times we have some ministry kind of guidelines and directives that we do too. So one of the ones that was most recent was kind of the, we became a hub, so a Smart Start hub. So we've become a one-door entry for any children and youth with physical or developmental issues that they would call our center. And if we're not the organization that would provide the direct services, we're capable of directing families to appropriate community partners. So I think there was a big, you know, we did a big campaign on that. We had big outreach. We did, you know, we visited all the communities in our catchment area and talked to doctors. We talked to, you know, Jen can help me remember all this, but nurse practitioner run clinics, the family health centers, schools. We did a big blitz to kind of get it out there of what our role is and who we are.
And really there's no, the philosophy is there's no wrong door. So anybody coming in with those questions, as Anne said, would be redirected to the appropriate service if John McGivney isn't the correct service. But the outreach also occurred with our Indigenous partners, different people with cultural backgrounds, multicultural council, really trying to get into the different cultures to help to understand and break down those barriers. So people, especially newcomers to Canada who may not know what our system is like, breaking down those barriers to assist in having families refer themselves or come in with a friend or a support system. And much like Anne mentioned, our Family Advisory Council as well as our Youth Advisory Council, we rely on them to put the word out and get the word out to friends and families. We also use social media, different social media portals. Even if it's just the fun stuff to say that we have a dance or we're having an ice cream social or something along that line, because we don't want it to be scary. It's a good place to be. A lot of wonderful things happen here on a daily basis. So really just trying to get that word out to people.
So I'm curious, when you mentioned you work with clients to help set individual goals, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about what a person with a disability can hope to achieve?
Good question. About what they hope to achieve or what others think that they can achieve?
What others think they can. I mean, sometimes a person can have that sort of glass ceiling imposed on them. What it's not, in fact, reality.
I think the people that work here are. We have a lot of seasoned staff, so I think we've been through kind of waves of different, you know, ability versus disability and proper, you know, words and names and stuff like that. So I think we're probably pretty good advocates for dispelling any of that, and kind of our philosophy has always been, you know, reach for the stars, trying to achieve your full abilities. So I think we're, you know, with a lot of our other programs that help support our core services, we're always out there trying to say, let us know. We have relationships in the community with the university and the college in terms of providing supports as well to their staff to help any clients that they have achieve their highest as well. So I think we're probably more of an advocate in terms of fighting for that stuff than we would be for seeing it as much almost.
So in that sense, I'd like to ask each of you this next one. In your time with the center, has there been any success story or moment that stands out for you?
I think we have successes every day. To see one of our therapists sent me a video, I think it was last week, maybe perhaps the week before, when I was new to the center. I'm coming up on 2 years. So when I was new to the center, I had sat in with a therapy session with a little one. I believe she was maybe 6-8 months at the time. They were told by the physician that she wouldn't be able to walk. And now coming on 2 years, I got a video of this little peanut, you know, walking from mom to the wall. And so those are huge successes. So in the eyes of some people, they might not be grand, but I think we truly see successes every single day in our clients.
I would agree. I think I've been here a very long time. So, you know, there's both personally from, you know, treating certain clients, hearing about certain clients from other clinicians and such. There's a thousand success stories. You know, we have kids that, you know, have risen above themselves and just gone out into the world and shown incredible strength and courage and just took on the world and did what they wanted to do and followed their dreams and had success at it. We have, you know, people employed in places that were that, wow, I wouldn't have thought that would have worked. And yep, they themselves made it work. So I think our philosophy and our kind of vision is we tend to, you know, look not at what people can't do, but what they can do. So for us, like some people would say, well, that's not a success, they can't walk. I'm like, but they can't walk, but they can get, they have the mobility, we've provided them with mobility, they can get to where they want to go. They can't talk, but we've provided them with assistive devices that help them communicate, so they can communicate, and they do so very well, right? So, because I think we have them daily, and I think there's probably thousands of success stories here.
Like, thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So, you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making a cocktail and having fun. Even when with friends, it's important to remember alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks can save a life. Then, you can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Safe.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Dr. Omira Osman told us a little bit about muscular dystrophy, and we heard from Ann Gerard and Jennifer Jovanovsky about the John McGivney Children's Center. Now, this next segment is also a post-dated interview, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Carolyn Hoffman will be telling us about SSADH. So, can you tell me a little bit about the association?
Yeah, the SSADH Association was created in part. We initially started, we have a son with a rare disease who he was diagnosed when he was probably 18 months old. And we were told he was the 81st case in the world to have this disorder. So no one in our area, we live in Wisconsin in the United States, and no one really knew much about the disorder or what to tell us to do for treatment or if there was any medication available that would help him. So we contacted the gentleman who diagnosed him was on the lab work that we got as part of the test results. So at the time, this Dr. Gibson was working at a lab in Baylor in Texas. So we called him in his lab. He was a PhD, not an MD. And he answered the phone, and we asked him, well, what should we do? Our son was just diagnosed. And he said, well, you should probably start raising money to fund research for the rare disorder because we don't know much about it. We don't know how it progresses. And he kind of connected us to a group of other parents that had similar rare neurological disorders that the main family was in New York. So we started together with five rare disorders, the Pediatric Neurotransmitter Disease Association. And we worked together that way for probably 14 years and then about maybe 7, 8 years ago, we went off on our own and said, we know what we want to do with the SSADH disorder, and we just move forward that way on our own.
So how does the disorder typically affect a person?
The disorder is succinic semialdehyde dehydrogenase deficiency. It kind of goes by SSADH. And the patients can't break down GABA, which we all have. So it impacts how your neurotransmitters communicate with each other, I guess is a good way to put it. So it globally affects them, their IQ, their ability to sleep, that physically they have impacts, they struggle with fine motor skills, language. So it's kind of a global affecting disorder. And there's a very wide spectrum. Some kids are in wheelchairs with feeding tubes and have seizures, and then there are other kids that are much higher functioning that can walk and talk and ride a two-wheel bike. So it's a challenging disorder in that regard that all the patients don't present the same.
So that being said, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
There's a huge risk of misdiagnosis. We have done prevalence studies, and there should be, like in the United States, there should be 333,000 patients, and we know of probably just over 100. So we know it's very underdiagnosed, very misdiagnosed. So we're trying to gradually try to get on like newborn screening and just to raise awareness with the doctors. There's not a lot of labs that do genetic testing, so we've contacted all the labs, at least in the U.S., and big labs throughout the world that do testing for medical tests, and It's hard to spread the word because it's so rare, but it's truly, like you said, very misdiagnosed and underdiagnosed.
So, as both a parent and an advocate for this condition, how do you keep yourself strong and motivated? I mean, it's got to be an uphill battle, as you said, raising awareness and therefore actually getting any substantive research into it.
Right. It's kind of a twofold. We've been Sam, my son Sam, is very much on the high end of the disorder. He's functioning. He has a job. He does volunteer work in the community. We just moved him into his own apartment. So in that regard, we always feel very blessed that he isn't struggling with seizures, that he's able to walk and talk. And on the other side of it, we have been so blessed with a team of doctors. We have an amazing group of doctors that have always engaged in the research side of things. And then we have a group of clinicians, of MD doctors, that have been kind of working hand in hand with the research doctors. So we started raising money for research. And so as much as we've been able to keep research moving forward, the doctors are willing to continue to do it. They seem to have an innate gift of reaching out to other doctors who they think can help and getting more and more doctors involved with it. We've had a natural history study that we got a grant from the National Institute of Health that was funded to look at the disorder over a 5-year period and see how it grows. So I think, you know, and it is very encouraging and very therapeutic. You know, when we get a new family diagnosed, it's great to be able to tell them, you're not alone. Here are some good next steps that you can take and connect them to other families with kids their age. And so I think it's really easy to stay encouraged every time you get a new family. You see the hardship it causes for them. So just to be able to encourage them to move forward and to be able to talk about, you know, how our son Sam has been so successful with the disorder. So it's and to be able to connect them to someone else so they know they're not alone in their struggles, because most doctors aren't aware of it. So I think that's it's encouraging to see the research going forward and to see studies happening. And, you know, as we get more and more patients, it's encouraging.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Friends, I must say I have great respect for the work of the McGivney Center, as it can be hard growing up with a disability, being a kid who acquires one in particular. I mean, you ask the questions of, what's still possible in my life? Am I still going to be the person I hope to be? The work that they do, finding ways to help young kids with disabilities to get stronger, both in their minds and their bodies, something really incredible. For if you reach them at a young age and show them that the world is not so hopeless or so small a place as we tend to think, they're going to grow up with a greater vision. They're going to look at what can be adapted. They're going to ask the question of, how can I make this work for me? And that is the right of any person in this world to explore their full potential, to see who they can become. Sometimes you hear about the glass ceiling effect, hear people saying all too often, you can't do this or you shouldn't try that. But working with young kids, with that fire of the spirit, that sense of, I want to see the world for what it is, you can help shape them into someone who grows up with a sense of strength and respect for those of different ability levels. From the disability community, it's all about playing off each other's abilities, working together to explore and to create. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.